You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Tom Burgess Watson.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda with Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck College in London. Oscar, what have you got?
Could the United States face another economic collapse and other stories of the class war raging in the Americas?
Looking forward to that. Thanks, Oscar. And Vladimir Putin meets his South Korean counterpart. Is this a realignment of fortunes for the once close ally of the North?
Plus, get your tongue ready, Tom. We'll be heading to Brooklyn to visit the only ice cream shop in New York City that makes the cold stuff completely on the premises.
I saw an opening for something that had passion behind it, where if we made peppermint patty ice cream, we made peppermint patties from scratch and chopped them up and put them in the ice cream. That really wasn't being done.
All that, plus we play some great music too. All of that to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up with the latest world news headlines with Mr. Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The Philippines President Benigno Aquino says the number of people killed by last week's typhoon is lower than previously thought. First estimates put the death toll at 10,000, but he says the true figure is likely to be up to 2,500. Aid agencies are warning that urgent action is needed to prevent that figure rising. The United Nations says Typhoon Haiyan affected more than 11 million people and around 673,000 have been displaced. Hills Hert is the chief coordinator of an emergency and disaster response team, BFAST, which arrived in the devastated city of Tacloban on Tuesday.
We are here to help the Philippine population, and they are suffering quite a lot, and I hope we can do a lot for them, bringing medicines and bringing clean water. Giving the medical care and making the water purification working, that's our job that we know how to do.
There's been criticism of the decision to elect China to the United Nations Human Rights Council. Russia, Saudi Arabia and Cuba were also elected, but campaigners say countries with dubious human rights records shouldn't be allowed onto the council. The UK's ambassador to the UN, Mark Lyle Grant, says China's election means its human rights record will now come under even closer scrutiny.
Clearly, we expect all those who are elected to the Human Rights Council to abide by the commitments they make. Abide by the general ethos and principles of the Human Rights Council. So whoever gets onto the council, we expect them very much to stick to those commitments, and we will hold them to it.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered a rethink over plans to build over 20,000 homes in the West Bank. His housing minister announced the plans on Tuesday, but Mr. Netanyahu has told him to reconsider, saying they'd create unnecessary international friction. He said building the homes would make no contribution to Jewish settlements and would create an unnecessary confrontation with the international community. The US had expressed their concern over the plans, while the Palestinians had said the move would kill off peace talks and they'd be appealing to the United Nations. The US State Department says two sailors kidnapped from a ship off the coast of Nigeria in October have been freed. The men were the captain and chief engineer of an oil supply ship which was stormed by gunmen on October the 23rd. Their names haven't been released, and the State Department gave no details of how they were released. No group has claimed responsibility, but the International Maritime Bureau says there have been 40 such attacks in the area this year. The Hawaii Senate has passed a bill extending marriage rights to same-sex couples in a state popular as a wedding and honeymoon destination and regarded as a pioneer in advancing the cause of gay matrimony. The measure cleared the Democratic-controlled state Senate by 19 votes to 4. Governor Neil Abercrombie, a Democrat who called a special session to consider the bill, is expected to sign it into law later today. Hawaii will then become the 15th U.S. state to legalize gay marriage. The measure, set to take effect on December the 2nd, rolls back a 1994 statute defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Nissan's CEO has opened a new $2 billion plant in Mexico and says it'll be producing 1 million cars in the country by 2016. Most of the cars from the new plant in Aguascalientes in central Mexico will be sent by rail to destinations throughout the Americas. The plant, which will assemble compact cars using engines built at Nissan's first Aguascalientes plant, is the company's third in Mexico. CEO Carlos Gossen says it will play a key role.
2016, we should be producing 1 million cars in Mexico, up from more than 600,000 today, so there is more to come. From the 1 million cars, about 300,000 should be for local production, because we obviously intend to maintain our leadership, even increase our leadership in Mexico. But there will be 700,000 cars exported, which means Mexico is becoming the export hub for the Americas.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Barney. It is precisely 8:06 Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, 26.
From London,
London, cara.
This is Monocle 24. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Tom Burgess Watson. Time now to set the day's news agenda with the three stories that we'll be keeping our eyes on throughout the day here on Monocle 24. I'm delighted to say that joining us in the studio is Oscar Guardiola Rivera of Birkbeck College here in London. Many thanks as always, Oscar. Lovely to see you as always. Where should we begin today? A bit of a disappointing, perhaps a bit scary news that you'd like to point out regarding an economic downfall for the Americans.
Yeah, this is a recent interview with American writer and broadcaster Tom Hartman. He joins a growing chorus of experts and journalists predicting that although things seem to be under control on the surface in the U.S., when you look you go around to the dark back side, as he put it, of the nation, you see the shocking truth that things are set to possibly a new economic collapse around 2016. The background to this story is an analysis by the Associated Press about the true impact of budget cuts, the deal that was made with Republicans in order to get out of the deadlock last week, but also the difficulties in rolling out Obamacare and so on.
It looks, reading this, that the United States, according to that report, is increasingly a country of haves and have-nots, but in a more profound way, in a more impactful way than perhaps ever seen before.
That's correct. The AP report is saying that the spending has already been frozen at 2013 levels. Federal funding for food stamps, this is a key example, is going to be cut by nearly $10 billion over the next decade. And also a very important program called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, which provides food aid to one in seven Americans. Apparently close to 170,000 U.S. military veterans would be disqualified from this program.
But I'm going to take, Oscar, the position of, I guess, a fiscal conservative here. America has been spending far too much than it's actually earning. Its deficit has been spiraling out of control over the last couple of years. You've got two huge white elephants in the room when you talk about Medicare and Social Security and how those things need to get reformed. But it doesn't look like any of that's going to happen on Capitol Hill. So they do need to make these spending cuts if they want to, I guess, preserve some sort of economic stability in the future.
It is true to say that budget cuts are needed. What is not clear is at all is why those cuts are being done in sectors which will affect the weakest. For instance, no cuts on military budget, quite the opposite, increase. So what you see there is really political decisions, not just economic common sense. And that seems to be the problem, precisely because what this will mean by 2016 is a widening gap between the have and have-nots. And of course, that also has political consequences.
These are very wealthy, powerful interest groups that are, in some people's view, not democratic, basically rising the ranks on the income scale whilst others are left very firmly behind. Another story you've picked out for us is that, well, it's a related story, really. This sort of rich versus the poor, the gulf between the two is already a real reality, isn't it, in many countries in the Americas?
That's true. If people like Harman predict that by 2016 the U.S. might find itself in more uncertain waters than it already is, well, that seems to be the case already in countries like Venezuela and other left-leaning countries like Argentina, which governments have taken measures to protect the poor. This week, in a televised address, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said he wanted to set legal limits on businesses' profit margins. The announcement followed the seizure on Saturday of shops accused of selling electronic goods at inflated prices. And he now says that he's going to extend these price controls to foodstuffs shops and clothing shops and so on and so forth. Of course, this is anathema for this must sound as anathema for most economic commentators.
And of course, this is in countries where inflation currently riding above 50% in some of these places. Some analysts arguing that Maduro and others are taking inspiration from communist Cuba.
That's true. In fact, that was the accusation, coming from opposition leader Enrique Capriles. He said that the president is a failed puppet of the Cuban government. He also said that every time Maduro opens his mouth, investment is scared, unemployment worsens, and so on and so forth. What is interesting here is to see how whenever price controls are announced and the focus is on the effect on inflation. And it is true to say that inflation is running pretty high in countries like Venezuela, 50% or more, according to official data. But it is also the case that when we look at countries in which joblessness has reached over 60%, it doesn't seem to arouse the same kind of reaction. And this is what makes some of Maduro's supporters arguing that what we're seeing here is once again politics. The president has spoken of an economic war being waged against Venezuela, and he has announced the arrest of some of the shop owners, inflating prices.
Could have all gone so differently for Venezuela after that election. It was such a close one as well. And had Capriles won, what a different place it would have been.
Sure.
A country we don't tend to think of in quite the same way when it comes to that really bitter class warfare and that kind of talk is Brazil. But maybe we're mistaken for not thinking of Brazil. Tell us why.
Well, we saw the protests last week, and I just came back from Brazil. And what when you talk to the people, what is clear is that there is mounting social and political tension. I'm ready to bet that the World Cup next year is going to be very interesting, not precisely because of sporting reasons. Brazil is in the news today all over the place. Dilma Rousseff has announced a series of measures to respond to U.S. spying on the internet. Particularly, she is unveiling legislation that would require all online information concerning Brazilians to be stored physically in Brazil. And this last measure would have big implications, particularly for big U.S. internet companies operating in Brazil.
That's a big concern there, because when you look at the situation in Brazil, it's a huge market when you think of these internet companies around the world. Could this potentially not be an opportunity, or perhaps this is a missed opportunity for Brazil, that they could essentially become a Silicon Valley hub of South America, of this part of the world, if they perhaps were a bit more freewheeling when it came to their policies towards internet companies?
Well, there are two sides to this story. One of them is precisely, as you mentioned, Phil, those who worry that these kinds of measures will scare big US internet companies who face the challenge of having to reproduce the infrastructure that they already possess offshore. And there are others who put it very clearly. Glenn Greenwald, for instance, the well-known whistleblower, is saying that this is a natural reaction to NSA's activities and that the opportunity is in these countries developing their own independent infrastructure.
And how much of this is politics for Rusev?
Well, there is...
Because, of course, she will be heading to the polls next year.
There is
this
a big
plays
reason.
Well, potentially, domestically.
That is very important because there is widespread anger among Brazilians at what happened with the U.S. And even the Financial Times today saying that the U.S. only has itself to blame. But again, the issue here is whether or not Brazil will join countries like Russia and others which are developing their own intranet infrastructure, or else whether we could see U.S. companies also standing up to government snooping.
Well, I think we've managed to pretty comprehensively cover the entire Americas. Thank you very much indeed for that, Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck College here in London.
Thanks very much for joining us. Coming up after this very short break, we'll be in Seoul to see if Russia is realigning its fortunes away from Pyongyang.
Learning from a master is a privilege in any sphere. To nurture ideas for the arts, Rolex's Mentor and Protégé initiative has been teaming leading practitioners with promising protégés around the globe. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound hopped over to Venice to talk to some protégés and mentors.
Everybody's moved out of institutional thinking and behavior and moved into something that's way easier, more honest, more direct, and more collaborative. As an artist, it's not interesting to be a private genius. What you want is to be part of a movement.
You can watch Rob Bound's film on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 17:16 in Seoul, it's 15:16 in Hanoi, and 8:16 here in London. Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin has left the rather comfortable surroundings of the Kremlin and is currently traveling across East Asia in a bid to shore up investment deals and bring in a much-needed injection of cash from the booming economies of the Far East.
Well, Putin was in Vietnam yesterday and is currently in South Korea for a two-day visit. It's an opportune moment for the South Koreans and their Russian counterparts towards Seoul, to pivot towards Seoul and away from Pyongyang. Well, on the table is a long-awaited rail expansion deal that will bring back life to a 21st century version of the Silk Road connecting Europe with Asia. Well, to find out more, we're joined on the line by Jason Strother, Monocle's Seoul correspondent, and Joshua Yaffa, who's in Moscow. Good morning to you both. Why don't we begin in Seoul with you, Jason. Putin there in Seoul. What kind of a welcome is being afforded to him, given that we would normally associate Russia as being a friend of the North more than the South?
I think those kind of political differences are put aside when it comes to what South Korea sees as an economic necessity. South Korea is working hard to open up investments with Russia, have Russia open up investments with South Korea. They just signed a $500 million fund to help national companies do cross-border trade. That's because South Korea has no natural resources, and it sees cooperating with Moscow, with President Putin, as an opportunity to secure its energy needs over the long term.
And of course, Jason, in order to do this, they need to have access to at least some parts of North Korea if they want, for example, this rail link to go ahead. There's also plans for a potential gas pipeline to go from Russia to South Korea. The first thing that strikes me is that if any kind of this, you know, if there indeed was this rail link, they would need the permission of the North. And of course, in the last couple of months, we've spoken about quite a bit about the Kaesong industrial complex and how that was shut after negotiations went quite awry. Isn't there the worry that, you know, if the North doesn't get their way on certain issues, they could just suddenly decide to shut down parts of this rail link or gas link if it gets built?
Sure, that's exactly the problem. Now, President Putin's and PAC, they signed a MOU, a memorandum of understanding on participation for this rail link. In September, the tracks were reopened between a small Russian town, Kasan, and the North Korea's ice-free port of Rasan. But yeah, but will actually Seoul be able to operate in North Korea? That remains anyone's guess. South Korea would like to eventually see a direct rail link that runs through North Korea, as well as its gas pipeline, for its energy security, for its export needs. But given what's happened here on the Korean Peninsula in the past, over the past year, it's going to take a lot of trust building with Pyongyang in order to make these two projects a success.
Jason, stay with us, because I'd like to just cross now to Joshua Yaffa in Moscow. Joshua, Putin in Seoul, as we've just been hearing, lots on his agenda. Is there a bit of confusion there in Russia amongst our generation and the generation before, who grew up perhaps thinking that Seoul and the South was evil and capitalist, and that their true friends were in the North, in Pyongyang?
I think long ago, Russia's policy towards the Korean Peninsula stopped being ideological and became based in Russia's Putin-era calculation of realpolitik and understanding its kind of geostrategic position in East Asia. In other words, it has long protected, though not fully, and kind of fit parts the regime in Pyongyang. I don't think out of any nostalgia for days of communist cooperation, but rather because it would like to create various points of balance against especially U.S. influence in East Asia, but also the rather complicated game or complicated understanding it has of the Chinese position in the region. Russia at once seeks to deepen ties with China, build up that strategic relationship, but of course has long been wary of China, China's reach in the region growing too deep and perhaps growing into Russia itself. So there's a wariness towards China. There's a long-standing suspicion, if not hostility, towards the expansion or overreach of U.S. Influence in the region. And I think that really is what has underpinned Russia's policy towards North Korea more than some kind of outdated ideological conception. That said, inertia, for whatever reason, is hard to overcome in any policy, especially in the case in a place like Russia, where things move very slowly and policy shifts very slowly. So it'll be interesting to see if Russia can pull off this kind of delicate balancing act of deepening ties with the South, while certainly not completely throwing under the bus its longtime partner.
Absolutely, Josh. We're going to leave it there with you in Moscow and turn back to Seoul, where our Jason Strother is. Jason, a little earlier you mentioned about those trust-building exercises, but it's not going to go very well when you consider that Putin and Park just pledged their commitments to UN sanctions on the North.
Well, that's exactly right. That's one of the takeaways from their summit here this afternoon. North Korea still needs Russia, even if Moscow does give lip service to the UN sanctions. Russia is still an ally. It's an economic ally. And like South Korea, North Korea sometimes ideological, adherence to ideology doesn't matter when it comes to cold, hard cash. And right now, with this rail link going into Russia, with Russian and Chinese investment going into the Rasan port, it's really what North Korea needs more than ideological allies.
And Jason, just very quickly, I know there was some banter about the Winter Olympics coming up.
Right. Well, of course, Sochi will soon be holding the Winter Olympics. And right after that, in 2018, Pyeongchang here in South Korea will be holding it. So I think we can see some sports cooperation taking place between the two nations. But Pyeongchang still has a way to go before the games are held there.
Thanks very much, Jason. Jason Strother there in Seoul. And before, we were speaking to Joshua Yaffa from Moscow.
Now, we continue our show with our daily check-in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we're off to Ramallah to discuss the latest news out of Israel and the West Bank with our woman there, Marika Peters. Good morning to you, Marika. A little bit of an about turn, it would appear, on the part of Bibi, Mr. Netanyahu, with regard to West Bank housing tenders. Tell us more.
Yeah, Definitely, yes. This is the announcement yesterday. Well, first of all, it started with an announcement of plans to build more than 20,000 new housing units in settlements across the West Bank. And then was followed by this rather surprising retraction from Netanyahu, who said that this move is, you know, going to damage Israel's standing, it's going to weaken its position in terms of Iran and persuading the Americans not to do a deal on Iran. And actually, what's very interesting about it is it turns out Bibi didn't even know about these tenders, which is rather strange because it's the largest one put forward in a decade, apparently.
It's actually really startling when you look at this issue and when you think about kind of negotiations over peace in this part of the world. It just seems like every move that Netanyahu and the Israelis are making is just one more nail in the coffin to any prospect of some kind of settlement or agreement. Should we assume that Middle East peace is just completely off the table?
I certainly don't want to be the person to make that pronouncement. But yeah, I mean, from the Israeli government's point of view, there are different tracks, I think, within the government itself. And one thing that's quite significant about this news is that Housing Minister Yuri Ariel, you know, he's the one who's really pushing for settlement construction. And the fact that he did this without consulting his own prime minister, you know, is rather embarrassing. So, while you've got the very right-wing hawks within the government, and of course, you know, Netanyahu is no left-winger, but you also have these elements and people who are really pushing for settlement construction, while I think the more diplomatic among them realise that is going to put an end to any peace settlement with the Palestinians. And indeed, you know, last night, as soon as this announcement was made, Mahmoud Abbas, phoned John Kerry and apparently phoned the Middle East Peace Quartet as well, threatened again to walk out of these negotiations. And they're actually holding emergency meetings in Ramallah today to discuss this. So it definitely does undermine the entire process.
Definitely a major thorn in the side of the Americans right now and indeed the rest of the international community. Another story you've picked out for us, the Israeli Defense Department suggesting that perhaps gas masks don't need to be produced in quite the same quantities as they did before.
Right. I mean, that's another turnaround that I think that came as a bit of a surprise to some people. This is news that the Defense Ministry in Israel is expected to recommend to the cabinet that they stop, that the government stops manufacturing and distributing gas masks to Israelis. Now, since about 5 years, all Israelis have been able to get gas masks for free. And during the summer, when it looked like there was going to be a strike with Syria, there were huge queues outside post offices, which is where you can get them. And again, last year, during the war with Gaza, it was a similar situation. In fact, they actually ran out of gas masks, and that was quite a big scandal. The Defense Minister is now saying that the threat of chemical attacks on Syria, on Israel has been reduced fairly significantly, so it's not necessary. But obviously, there's probably a financial consideration here because it's vastly expensive to provide these gas masks, which aren't being used.
And Marika, let's move on to another story that still people around the world are talking about. And that, of course, was the reinstatement of the new foreign minister. Well, the old foreign minister, I guess, once again, Lieberman. Seems that the Israeli public is they're quite a forgiving bunch.
Yeah, it seems so. You think they might be a bit upset with a foreign minister who'd been accused of corruption. But the coverage of Lieberman's reinstatement, which happened on Monday, been overwhelmingly positive, well, in the Israeli press at least. There's a hope, I think, that he can repair some of the damage that's been done in recent days between Netanyahu and John Kerry, who had a bit of a spat when John Kerry criticised Israel, both over continued settlement buildings and over Iran and its digging its heels in against any US plan with Iran. So I think there's a hope that Lieberman will be able to keep John Kerry on side, and he's actually already said that one of the things he wants to do is calm tension between the US and Israel. So we'll see how well he does with that.
Because I think a lot of people would perhaps suggest he was the source of quite a lot of tensions rather than in a position to calm them, because he's a deeply divisive individual.
You think certainly doesn't have any interest in negotiating with the Palestinians, and I think that's going to be a difficult point. Again, you know, this idea that there are all these separate tracks within the Israeli government, which aren't, you know, which are in opposition to each other. So it will be interesting to see if he can be persuaded to drop his opposition to these ongoing negotiations. Because if he doesn't, it's really going to continue to do more damage.
Marika Peters in Ramallah, thank you very much indeed for bringing us up to speed on events in your part of the world. Thank you so much. Well, in the next half hour of the program, we're going to be delving through today's Italian newspapers. We'll be hearing how Lithuania is once again divided about how to deal with its Soviet heritage. And we'll visit the only ice cream shop in New York that makes ice cream completely on the premises. It all starts with eggs, cream and sugar.
I saw an opening for something that had passion behind it, where if we made peppermint patty ice cream, we made peppermint patties from scratch and chopped them up and put them in the ice cream. That really wasn't being done.
Sounds yummy indeed. So lots to look forward to in the next half of the program. It's 8:30 here in London, which means it's time for a check of the world headlines. Here's Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Phil. The Philippines President Benigno Aquino says the number of people killed by last week's typhoon is lower than previously thought. First estimates put the death toll at 10,000, but he says the true figure is likely to be around 2,500. There's been criticism of the decision to elect China to the United Nations Human Rights Council. Russia, Saudi Arabia and Cuba were also elected, but campaigners say countries with dubious human rights records shouldn't be allowed on the council. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered a rethink over plans to build over 20,000 homes in the West Bank. He said the plans would create unnecessary international friction. The US State Department says two soldiers kidnapped from a ship off the coast of Nigeria last month have been freed. The men were the captain and chief engineer of an oil supply ship stormed by gunmen on October the 23rd. The Hawaii Senate has passed a bill extending marriage rights to same-sex couples. The state governor is expected to sign it into law later today, and Hawaii would then become the 15th U.S. state to legalize gay marriage. Nissan's CEO has opened a new $2 billion plant in Mexico and says it'll be producing a million cars in the country by 2016. Most of the cars from the new plant in Aguascalientes in central Mexico will be sent by rail to destinations throughout the Americas. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Barney Burnham. 8:32 Greenwich Mean Time. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Burgess-Watson, and Phil Hahn.
Well, Tom, I hope you have that tongue of yours ready because we're about to taste some ice cream. There's no lack of specialty food shops in Brooklyn, and one ice cream parlor has found a niche for itself with high-quality, made-from-scratch ice cream that comes in rather unusual flavors.
Yummy. Well, Ample Hills is probably the only ice cream shop in New York City that makes ice cream completely on the premises, starting with eggs, cream and sugar, and then getting a little bit inventive. Well, Monocle contributor Megan Dietrich spent a weekend at Ample Hills Creamery to find out what the neighborhood is clamoring about.
Even in early November, there's a crowd outside Ample Hills Creamery in New York City on Saturday afternoons. The small ice cream parlor in Brooklyn has become something of a mecca for the after-brunch ice cream seekers. Outside, customers relax, chatting over signature pretzel cones and soft serve, enjoying the sunny afternoon. Here I find Frank and Shira just finishing up a bowl of Mexican hot chocolate ice cream.
I like that it's a mix of high quality, kind of local, plus it has this kind of lowbrow flavor, so it's kind of a fun dichotomy. The Mexican hot chocolate is one of my favorites because even though I appreciate that they have these ridiculous flavors with all the stuff in them, I'm actually kind of an ice cream purist, so I like that it doesn't have any added ingredients except for the spiciness.
Frank says he loves all kinds of sweets, but when he gets ice cream, he comes to one place, Ample Hills.
I mean, there's no competition. It's just one of the best ice cream I've ever had.
Across the table from them, Arshad steals a spoonful of their ice cream. Despite owning a diet and exercise company, he says there's a real appeal to Ample Hill's made fresh and local ethos.
I mean, it's like a black hole, though. I mean, it's hard to avoid this place because it's on the corner, it's in a great neighborhood, you always walk by it. If you're gonna have that stuff, you might as well have something that's quality.
The ice cream and its fillings are made on-site from scratch. The flavors are inventive and playful. They have names like salted crack caramel, ooey gooey butter cake, and drunken pumpkin, which is a brown sugar bourbon and cinnamon ice cream with homemade pumpkin pie graham cracker cookies. Though small, the ice cream parlor, with its children's play area, cow murals on the wall, and a chalkboard of ever-changing flavors, feels like a place you could spend a day. Today, Jason Smith is behind the counter, dishing out ice cream and jokes.
If you could stand on the opposite side of the counter and see how much fun we're having, you understand why you're having fun at Apple Hills.
I don't know all your flavors, I haven't looked through them, but I need chocolate and peanut butter in a combination.
I don't know what I have before.
The only chocolate peanut butter we have has bacon in it. Is that cool?
Unbelievable. What?
Jason says two things make Apple Hills what it is: the sense of community and Brian Smith.
He's the owner and head chef of Apple Hills, and he is like the Willy Wonka of ice cream. He has like some sixth sense for making incredible flavors that are just out of left field.
When he was young, ice cream maker Brian Smith had three dreams.
To own an ice cream parlor, to make old-time radio dramas, and to write movies.
He'd made the radio dramas and the Monster of the Week movies for cable television, as well as produced audiobooks for various publishers.
We wrote a half alligator, half man movie, and the fun of trying to come up with a monster that you hadn't quite seen before, a variation on a theme, something, you know, about the humanity of the people running from this monster. It was always really fun to create that and to imagine the movie that was going to be. Writing, at the end of the day, is very lonely. Making ice cream is an instant gratification.
Though he'd sold a decent amount of movie scripts, it wasn't quite paying the bills. Now in his 40s, Brian wanted to put his creativity into something both he and his children could enjoy.
It just seemed like the time, with two little kids of our own, to kind of create an ice cream shop, to create an experience, almost more than the ice cream itself, you know, was to try to create that kind of mythic place, you know, where people want to gather and pass the time and where people know your name.
Brian took his family's life savings and signed a lease on a 900-square-foot storefront in a well-off neighborhood in northwestern Brooklyn 2 years ago.
I think that if I'd had to convince other people that it was a good idea, I don't think I could have. It's a tough sell to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to open up a place and with a new product and that kind of thing.
It seemed like a risky investment. With Americans spending less, who's going to drop 3.5 pounds on espresso ice cream with dark chocolate? Apparently, lots of people. The shop opened in early June 2011. It was so successful, it closed after 4 days. They'd sold out of ice cream.
We had not planned for success, and so after 4 days, it was clear that the management of the shop, the actual production capabilities that we'd set out to do, I just hadn't planned for being able to make enough ice cream. We spent 9 days being closed, in which we doubled the staff, we hired a bunch of new people, we created more ice cream, and that fear of reopening and wondering people are going to come back, you know, you've created this thing, there's this buzz and excitement, it's 4 days and they're gone, and there's just signs up saying, sorry, we're closed for 9 days. That was more anxiety than I'd like to experience again.
And that excitement hasn't died. In busy summer months, Apple Hills produces 500 gallons of ice cream a week, up from 150 gallons that first year. Even on this November afternoon, there's still a line of people ready to eat ice cream.
I saw an opening for something that was, you know, that had passion behind it, where if we made peppermint patty ice cream, we made peppermint patties from scratch and chopped them up and put them in the ice cream. That really wasn't being done.
Brian is constantly developing new recipes and testing out flavors on his staff.
It's important to sort of feel like the shop is an organic, living thing. Coming from an artistic or creative writing background, is, you know, wanting to always create something new. If I had to come into work every day and just make vanilla and strawberry and chocolate ice cream, I'd lose my mind. And so we're sort of constantly trying to come up with things that push the boundaries.
Apple Hills' whimsical artisanal ice cream is striking a sweet note. Brian has just put the finishing touches on a cookbook that'll teach you how to make his recipes at home. It'll be released this spring around the same time Apple Hills opens its second location in Brooklyn. an ice cream factory. For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietry.
And if you want to hear the latest edition of The Entrepreneurs, tune in. Sorry, too much
getting
ice
emotional.
Cream in my throat. Tune in at 1900 hours London time today. That's 1400 hours in New York and 11 a.m. in San Francisco.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a look at controversial plans to restore the Red Guards of Vilnius in Lithuania.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 8:40 in the morning here in London. Now, Lithuania was the first part of the Soviet Union to declare its independence more than two decades ago, and perhaps unsurprisingly, the country isn't too fond of its communist past. Now, the Lithuanian battle against old demons has recently translated to its heritage. In August, the mayor of Vilnius, a man by the name of Arturas Zvokas, pledged to pay for the restoration of statues of Red Army soldiers that have fallen into decay. That's a plan that could cost up to $200,000.
Well, now the city is divided between those who believe Soviet heritage should be preserved and those who refuse to pay for monuments that still trumpet an ideology Lithuania has grown to detest. Well, joining us now to discuss this further is James Cantor, International New York Times' EU correspondent, who has been covering the story for the paper. James, welcome to the program. Set the scene for us a bit. Why are these statues on the Green Bridge so divisive?
Well, the statues are very striking. I mean, number one, it's quite rare these days to see statues in a sort of realist tradition. And the statues have very detailed work. You can see the clothing. You can see coats flapping in the wind. And, you know, on the other hand, these statues are there more than two decades later in one of the countries that, as you said in your introduction, first declared independence from the Soviet Union and retains a great loathing for that period in its history.
In your opinion, James, are these statues of any artistic merit whatsoever?
I asked a lot of people about that, and in fact, the some of the people who know a great deal about art history in that region of the in the world, they say that the statues are really quite important in the sense that they represent the brigade style of Soviet realism. This is the idea that a group of classically trained sculptors would have sculpted these four sets of statues that stand on all four corners of the bridge in a kind of anonymous fashion. We do know now who these sculptors were, and one of them is in fact still alive, but he's really very elderly and it wasn't possible for me to speak to him.
And James, before the show, Tom and I were talking about these statues on the Green Bridge and how important they are. You know, they play a role when it comes to the city's tourism industry, and I'm just on the official Vilnius tourism website for the country, and it lists the Green Bridge as one of its main attractions. So obviously this plays a big part in the city's tourism sector, doesn't it?
I'm quite surprised to hear that, actually, because I was perusing some of their publicity materials, some of the national publicity materials, including the in-flight magazine from one of their airlines, and it had a photograph of the Green Bridge with one of the more modernist sculptures underneath the bridge, but it notably excluded and completely eliminated any sign of these Stalin era statues. So to hear that they're actually publicizing the statues themselves would be, I think, something of a surprise. But you know, maybe they're maybe they're changing their publicity.
Well, four rather large pictures on their website for the Green Bridge, and they mentioned that the images on the site relate to our agriculture, industry, education, and the army. So perhaps there is a changing mood in the city.
Yeah, well, I think that there's certainly a change. There's certainly a changing mood in the country. About three quarters of people either don't really mind the statues or would prefer for them to stay on the bridge. However, if you go to the second city of the country, Kaunas, you'll find a lot of young people there who think that these remnants from that period really ought to be taken to the Soviet-era theme park in the south of the country that is run by this rather interesting guy called Malinauskas.
I love the sound of this theme park, and I wanted to ask you about it because it's sort of making light, isn't it, slightly, of what was a very, very dark chapter. And I'm just wondering, if I went to that theme park, apart from a large statue of Lenin, which apparently has birds roosting in its missing right thumb, what else might I see there?
You would be... You walk in and you're greeted by women in these Soviet-era red neckerchiefs and white tops. You can dine in a canteen which serves Soviet-era cuisine. So these are really pretty standard things like hot, you know, their version of hot dogs and borscht. And then you see these massive, massive monuments, many of which are made of bronze or iron, lying in misty groves, which take about 30 minutes to walk around. And it's quite eerie. I mean, on the one hand, you're struck by some of the magnificence and quality of the sculptures, but on the other, you know, you're struck by how this, you know, art from a totalitarian era has come to a rather lonely end.
And it's not too expensive to visit that theme park. Only $8, Tom. So next
Sounds
time,
creepy.
Next time we're there, we should visit. But elsewhere around the city, there are some rather interesting statues that have been propping up, and they seem to be celebrating some rather unique individuals from American music. And I'm namely speaking Frank Zappa, of course, and the Englishman John Lennon.
Yeah, the Zappa statue went up in the 90s. A group of rather sort of puckish artists thought that Zappa was the ideal emblem of a new era of free expression. You know, the ponytailed Zappa sits there in, you know, near the Vilnius Old Town, which is a UNESCO heritage site, incidentally, with its Baroque-era churches. And then the Lenin statue went up in Lukishka Square, which is opposite the old KGB headquarters and where that statue of Lenin, where the birds now roost, used to stand. And it was made of sand, and it was taken down just a few months later for safekeeping, leaving Lukishka rather eerily desolate and still empty after more than two decades. And again, there's sort of a similar debate over the fate of Lukishka. The Lithuanians and the people of Vilnius just cannot decide what should replace Lenin.
James, it is a fascinating story indeed. Many thanks for joining us here on the program. James Cantor from the International New York Times.
It was interesting, we were just talking about Frank Zappa there, because in fact he was of French and Italian origin. I was just looking him up because I was checking.
You're very curious. Proud, aren't you, of your French heritage?
Well, not really. It's more my Italian roots that were interesting on that
Don't
occasion.
Don't give any credit to the Americans.
Which leads us very neatly into our next segment, which is all about Italy, because we're going to be checking out the front pages from Italy. And to get us there, here's a little bit of, Italian pop music. Here is the singer Francesca Michelin with her song Sola.
Was the very lovely dulcet tones of Francesca Michelin there with Sola. Are you a fan, Tom?
I was inspired to find out more about her, which I did.
And what she have you found?
She won the X Factor, and she's only 18, so she's going places, I would say. And that song was kind of catchy.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good for a...
Yeah, it's an unusual name she has. She's from the Veneto region of Italy.
Because when you look at it, you think it's almost French, don't
looks
you?
Looks like Michelin. Michelin, I think they call it in English. I don't know why. I've never been able to say Michelin. Anyway, Michelin, as in the guidebooks and the maps and the tires, it looks like that, but it's not that. It's Michelin, which is a northern Italian setter. Anyway, let's carry on talking about Italy, because David Pleasant has just walked into the studio and he's going to be talking us through the Italian press. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Tom.
You've picked out a story from La Repubblica, which is in front of you. What's all this about?
Yes, this is something that's been cropping up again and again on the front pages. And before we kind of get bogged down into the details, it does involve electoral reform. So let's not kind of dwell too long on it. But it is quite important because basically the Italian parliament has been trying as hard as possible to basically reform the so-called Porcellanum laws of 2005 that were brought in by Berlusconi's government. Porcellanum is Latin for pigsty. So they are so kind of widely hated, these laws of 2005, that they are called the pigsty laws. They were basically brought in to try and kind of form a two-party, a kind of bicameral situation within the parliament, try and kind of tidy things up. In so doing, they're widely seen as basically kind of whipping the carpet out of any kind of democratic principles within the parliament, creating these kind of lists of candidates, whereby the electorate is unable to directly vote in candidates. So there is a consensus to try and change these laws, this system, but that is just not getting anywhere.
And they've been wanting to change this broken system for quite some time now. But I guess it's all really about the big players in this and who actually can get things done. You've got people like Letta, Renzi, Berlusconi still control some amount of power there in Italy. What's your take on the situation?
Well, that's exactly it. And Matteo Renzi, the kind of aspiring leader of the center-left movement, the new candidate, the future candidate, has just kind of completely whipped his support from the latest reform proposals. So it's back to square one for that. He's supposing a whole different kind of course for the reform of the electoral system. What's interesting is 87% of Italian citizens agree that bicameralism needs to be changed. So there's huge amounts of support, and the president, Napolitano, is increasingly angry with parliamentarians for not managing to fix this problem. But Matteo Renzi isn't actually helping the problem at the moment by saying that the reform proposals are complete rubbish.
Well, that story seems to dominate the first four or five pages of La Repubblica, which must make for rather, well, it was slightly depressing reading, really, the chaos.
I wonder if there's been a day in recent history where Italian politics and dysfunction was not on one of the front pages of an Italian paper.
I know, it's a bit sad, but there are other issues going on.
There are, and there's one, in fact, in that very same newspaper you picked out for us, a man who's been acquitted in a trial whereby he was charged with denying the Holocaust in Rome. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, that's right. This case revolves around Roberto Valvo, an ex history teacher, a retired history teacher at a high school in Rome. Basically, what happened was that there was a strike, public transportation strike, preventing many students to get to the school. There were three students there, and over the course of 3 days, he kind of went into this diatribe of his version of the Holocaust, whereby he kind of disputed a lot of the facts and figures of what he deemed to be the numbers affected in the Holocaust. And when, I mean, a kind of extraordinary kind of list of things that he is said accused of saying. In any case, he's been acquitted, which is somewhat surprising. But this case has been going on for about 4 years, and it kind of opens up this whole... there has been this revaluation of anti-Semitism and, you know, with the state of kind of the Italian kind of acceptance of its Jewish history.
Well, David, from a rather serious and depressing story, perhaps to a lighter story, but still a bit depressing. it's all about bird poo.
Yeah, if anybody knows Rome, they might know that about this time of year, the city is kind of flooded with starlings, millions, about 4 million starlings drop off, kind
literally
of stop off in Rome on their way to Africa. And the city's always had, lately had a budget to kind of look after the mess that they inevitably make. This budget's actually been cut right back. And this piece in the Stamper, Turin's paper actually, is saying that, I mean, the amount of the kind of treachery that is going to be caused by these millions of birds over the city.
It's going to be a messy time in Rome. David, thanks very much for joining us today on the program. Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Maddie Arouche, and our studio manager, Alex Funnel. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York. I'll be lucky. I'll be back with Tom tomorrow for the same time at for Midori House. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Tom Burgess-Watson, thank you very much for listening.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.